My name is Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute. Welcome to The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, publisher of the Saturday Paper and the Monthly, and by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday Paper is a great source of long-form journalism. I read it every weekend. The Monthly is the country's best-selling magazine of politics, culture and ideas. They even publish some of mine from time to time. This is the second week of The Lucky Country. Thanks for joining me. Been enjoying the feedback I've got from last week's episode, had some great ideas and some great questions from listeners, and I'll be dealing with some of those later in the show. If you want to contact us, feel free to email at theluckycountry@schwartzmedia.com.au. This week's episode takes a close look at the economics and politics of mental health, and in particular, the way that some of our economic policies don't just make treating mental health more difficult, that some of our policies are actually contributing to causing mental health problems in Australia. I know economics could seem like a weird perspective to view the complex problems of mental health through, and to be clear, if you or someone you care about is dealing with mental illness, then I strongly encourage you to reach out to one of the many support groups like Beyond Blue, Lifeline or Black Dog who are there to help. Their contact details will be provided at the end of the show. But while economists aren't expert in mental health care, I do think we can actually add something to the debate about what to do about it, and indeed why we should do more about it. I'm in no way qualified to offer advice to individuals who are suffering from mental illness, but hopefully I can offer some new perspectives on how the shape of our public debates can contribute to mental illness. I'll be talking to some great guests about what we might do to make things better as well.
We are a nation of lifters, not leaners.
Modern politicians love to put people into categories, but while creating artificial divisions between people and then barracking for one team over another might make the task of politics easy, it makes the task of building a cohesive society much, much harder. The purpose of Joe Hockey's distinction between lifters and leaners was to force people to choose which group they thought they belonged to, and then, having made that choice, to distance themselves from the other group. His party's polling would have told him that most potential Liberal voters would see themselves as lifters, and taking the side of the majority is one version of good politics. I'm doing the scare quotes here with my fingers when I say good politics, of course. But while making people look down on leaners might have shifted some votes, the worst thing we can do for people suffering from depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, or many other mental health problems is to push them away from the rest of the community, to make it hard for them to reach out and ask for help.
Our reluctance in years past to talk openly about mental health issues has been a real barrier to destigmatising mental illness. But as a nation, we've started to talk about it and the devastating impact it has on so many people. And once we acknowledge the problem, the issue, then we're better able to address it.
But while mental health professionals work tirelessly to encourage people with mental health problems to ask for help when they need it, and while politicians of all stripes support days like Are You OK Day that are designed to make it easier for people to ask for help, the fact is that neoliberal attacks on bludgers and leaners make it much harder for people in need to ask for help. And of course, neoliberal attacks on the funding for both acute and preventative mental health care make it so much harder to provide help to those who are brave enough to put up their hand. While the idea that prevention is better and cheaper than cure has as much empirical support as it does common sense appeal, the fact is that conservative governments often see preventative policies such as these as a waste of money or a luxury we can't afford. Of course, they're always happy to support preventative policies when it comes to defence and national security. Despite the overwhelming evidence that preventative health policies, preventative crime policies, and preventative environmental policies can not just pay for themselves, but help individuals and communities avoid needless suffering, successive state and federal governments keep cutting funding to these important services. Even though the financial costs of treating people who've harmed themselves or incarcerating people who've harmed others is far, far higher than preventing it from happening, for some reason, governments seem to see cutting spending on preventative policies as a saving rather than a risk. While it's easy to focus on the financial costs, The stress, the anxiety, and the physical pain that often result from a failure to prevent acute mental health episodes is incalculable and incredibly destructive.
We have a lot of work ahead of us, but we are making progress. We're committed to bring the budget back into balance because we don't want to leave our children and grandchildren with an enormous mountain of debt, which can only mean in the future that they, if we don't live within our means, that they would have to pay higher taxes or receive lesser services from government, or probably both.
It's much easier to cut spending on mental health care than it is to cut tax concessions for superannuation or cut the subsidies that we give the coal industry. The reason for this is simple. It's money. While the finance sector and the mining industry spends a fortune on PR and lobbying to make sure the money keeps flowing to them, the mental health sector struggles to provide enough rooms and enough time to support some of the people who need it most in our community. And while mining and bank executives have no qualms about demanding more money for their industry, needless to say, those suffering from mental illness feel a bit less confident standing up in front of the nation to demand their fair share. As Mahatma Gandhi once said, a nation's greatness is measured by how it treats its weakest members. But in 2016, two mental health centres closed in Adelaide due to a cut in federal funding. At the time, mental health professionals said, and I'm quoting here, "What we'll actually see is we'll have probably more mental health patients presenting at the emergency departments, but with much more acute symptoms." It doesn't save us money to spend less money on mental health care. It costs us money in the long run. But despite all the evidence, we continue to do it. Similarly, in describing a decision of the Turnbull government to scrap the internationally recognised Headspace program, a program for young people experiencing psychosis, Professor Alan Rosen from Wollongong University declared, and I'm quoting here, "This abandonment of seriously ill young people and their families is a national tragedy in the making." But again, it's not just the willingness of our leaders, the leaders of one of the richest countries in the world, to skimp on mental health services that causes so much harm. What we have to question is the determination of some of those leaders to depict people in need as leaners or bludgers, rather than fellow citizens that are brave enough to ask for help.
Believe me, from my heart, the best way, the most profound way to honour the Anzacs of a century ago is to support you, the Anzacs of today, the veterans and your families today.
Of course, there's no doubt that we should support today's soldiers and vets. But of course, the best way to really honour the Anzac spirit would be for all of our elected representatives to emulate that Anzac spirit when it comes to providing support to all those people in our community who need our help. Joining me now is Professor Alan Fells, Chair of the National Mental Health Commission, former head of the ACCC, and also Chair of the Haven Foundation, which provides accommodation and support for those with long-term mental health issues. Thanks for joining us, Alan.
Thank you, Richard.
Look, we hear so much about how important it is to encourage people who are experiencing mental health problems to reach out and ask for help. But at the same time, our political debate often demeans people at their times of need. And, you know, we call people on welfare bludgers. We talk about lifters and leaners. Do you think these mixed messages help create an environment in which people who need help feel confident to ask for it?
No, they have a bad effect. And the fact is that one of the biggest problems of mental health is that people don't come forward and get help or treatment or care. And sending out those messages that you said does have all those bad effects in further repressing it.
And you know, we're both economists and we're here talking about mental health. Who'd have thought that would happen? But there are economic dimensions to this. I mean, the old adage is prevention is cheaper than cure. Is that your experience in the mental health area?
Yes. The fact is that the cost to GDP of mental illness is about 4%. Of course, it's a devastating social problem as well. But 4% is a very big number, and mental health can be greatly improved. Mental illness can be recovered from to a significant degree. in many cases totally. In other cases, you can just get improvement to the best possible condition of life. So it is a worthwhile investment.
And what are we talking about here? What kind of interventions do we have evidence work? What do we need to do more of if, as a society, we wanted to not just help individuals with the enormous consequences of mental health, but if, as a society, we wanted to build a more efficient system? What do we got to do more of? What do we got to do less of?
We've got to reallocate resources. At the moment, very few resources go into prevention and early intervention. And as a result, there's a disproportionate number of people who end up going into hospital and other expensive forms of care. So we have to reallocate towards the pre-investment end. That is quite difficult to do. There's other things that don't require spending. The whole system is not terribly well organised. It's quite difficult to navigate, get treatment. Also, there's no continuum of service. Say you're in a hospital and you leave it, you might sleep under a bridge the following night, and then you're likely to go back into hospital. We haven't got a continuous so-called step-down, step-care system of mental health care. There are big gaps in the middle. Primary is kind of okay if you go to a GP, a psychologist. Acute is fairly good in hospitals, but there's a huge empty hole in the middle, partly but inadequately filled by community mental health services. They need to be expanded and improved. And a range of important social supports like better accommodation, better chance of getting jobs, better handling of it at work, if we could tackle them, we'd get better results.
Economists often like to assume that that markets are efficient ways of allocating resources, in part because we think consumers are rational, that consumers are good at looking after themselves. Yet you've just described quite a complex yet incomplete system. It must be very hard for people with mental health problems to not just put their hand up, but to navigate a system as complex as the one you just described.
That's correct. Just to take two examples. Physical health and mental health. The physical health of people with severe mental illness is bad. The life expectancy is 20 years worse than for the rest of the population. And one of the reasons is that treatment's not coordinated. The mental health specialists, whether they're doctors or nurses, don't worry about the physical health of people with mental illness. If, on the other hand, you go to a GP or other healthcare person, the treatment is overshadowed by their perception of you being mentally ill. So I go in myself, I say I've got a sore back, taken seriously. I go in, they know I have a mental illness, I say a sore back, tends to be ignored. There are other reasons for the bad physical health of people with mental illness, but we could do a lot more to coordinate the treatment. Another problem area is so-called dual diagnosis, drugs and mental illness. They tend to be treated separately when an integrated treatment is required.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Alan. But before we wrap up, you've obviously been working in the policy domain around mental health for many years now, but obviously you've got direct personal experience of the impact of mental health. Would you like to talk a little bit about your personal experience of living with people that are in need of support for mental illness?
Yes. Well, my daughter has had schizophrenia for 25 years. It's a devastating illness that affects her quality of life enormously and also has a devastating effect on the family because it's all-consuming. At the schizophrenia end, untreated, a person tends to have hallucinations, delusions, all sorts of frightening noises going off in her head, gunshots and things. They might want to throw themselves out of windows, complete loss of self-control. To a degree, that can be treated by medicine, but not terribly well. and the concentration and life skills of people at the serious end that's very poor, and they need a lot of backup and support. They can't really typically lead terribly independent lives. Also, it's not just a medical matter. It's a matter of addressing the whole of their life. Things like accommodation, which provides a lot more stability and helps overcome some of the mental illness problems.
Well, thank you so much, Alan, not just for joining us today, but for your work in the policy domain and for opening up to the listeners what the reality of these experiences are. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
That was Alan Fells. Back in 2013, the Gillard government introduced the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, a scheme designed to provide a wide range of services to people suffering from severe and permanent disabilities. Today I'm joined by Dr. Gemma Carey and Eleanor Malbon from UNSW Canberra's Public Sector Research Service to talk about the NDIS, how it works, when it doesn't work, and how it helps people with mental illness. So Gemma, what on earth is the NDIS?
So the National Disability Insurance Scheme replaces what was called a very piecemeal and fragmented disability service arrangement that was different from every state to state with a more national system. The idea is that if you have a permanent or severe disability that you have for life, you are fully funded by the scheme as an insurance scheme for services and support. It won't provide you with income support, but it'll provide you with any kind of services and support that you need.
Sounds perfect.
It sure does.
What do you think of that, Eleanor? Is it perfect?
It's not quite perfect, but just to clarify, the main difference in the shift to the NDIS is that beforehand, money was going from the government directly to service providers who were then providing services based on those grants. Now the money goes directly to people with disability. They are able to go in and meet with their local NDIS planner and they create a plan about what they want from their care, and then they get that funded and they can then go to service providers and say, I have this budget, can you please give me these kind of services?
So if I become paralysed in a car accident, money would come to me to allow me to set my house up the way I need, yep. Get a wheelchair if I need, get the physiotherapy I need. I'm in charge of my own care.
That's right.
Well, again, sounds great. Gemma, what could go wrong?
So that's the ideal. To get that budget, you need to go and sit down with a planner. Your planner may or may not have any experience in dealing with people with a disability or any training, and that planner will make a decision on what you are and are not entitled to.
A decision?
A decision.
And entitled.
Yes.
I don't feel as empowered anymore.
No. You're caught in a bureaucratic process at that point. So how well you fare under it might depend on how good you are at explaining what's wrong, what you need, advocating for yourself, whether you know that you can and should take someone into a planning meeting with you to advocate for you, what kinds of paperwork from doctors you might want to bring with you to support your case that you have X, Y, Z needs, not just X needs.
Wow, so in 2 minutes we've jumped from patients being in control to planning and paperwork.
Yes.
Who is this planner?
So the planners are employed by government, so they're bureaucrats.
Yep. Okay, it's not sounding as empowered as the original scheme.
So they work for the National Disability Insurance Agency. That's the main implementation agency. So you have a scheme that is funded predominantly by the Commonwealth Government, but a whole new body was set up to implement it called the National Disability Insurance Agency. It is a bit of a black box, so nobody really knows completely what's going on in there. They employ the planners. The planners can come from anywhere. As I said, they may have no expertise in disability. They may have worked in disability sector for decades and have great expertise, so highly variable experience.
So some disabled people might be getting great advice from experienced mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. in the system, and
yep.
some might be dealing with someone who's just moved into the disability sector because they couldn't get a job somewhere else.
Yes, and before sitting down with somebody to work out their plan, they've never actually worked with anyone with a disability before, but they will be making a decision. Say if you had a child who had a particular needs, they would be making a decision about whether or not your child actually had those needs.
Wow, I'm feeling less in control and less in control. Eleanor, how do you think it's working? Where do you think the problems are going to emerge?
Like Gemma said, I think the problems emerge around whether or not someone is able to advocate for themselves or bring somebody into the space to advocate for them. I think this scheme can actually work very well for people who are very clear about what services they need and that those services are either available or they can work with a service provider to get that service available. So they might have someone who they've been working with for 3 years and they say, look, I would really like somebody to come and live in with me, to be there morning and evening before I go to work, to help me to wash, prepare dinner, etc. And they've got an existing relationship. The service provider says, yes, I'm happy for that to happen. If you don't have that kind of set of clarity around what you would like from your plan and your set of care, then you might end up going with the same kind of care that you were before, which might not be exactly what you want, but it's difficult to fully articulate what it is that you do want from this scheme.
And what if I lived in a pretty small town and I was the only person in town that had a particular disability? Great, I've got this budget to go buy services. Will the market always provide what I need?
You're in trouble.
I'm disabled. This is here to help me. What could go wrong?
One of the biggest challenges is regional and remote areas, creating that market. So the idea that you can go out and purchase any kind of service within, you know, within reason, that meets your needs is dependent on the idea that there is a marketplace there for you to purchase it from. So, and that's not one national marketplace. Like you said, that's lots and lots of local markets. So if you live in a city, you're probably okay. There's a lot around, although some people in cities are still struggling and services are closing as a result of the NDIS. If you live in a remote or regional area, you're probably going to only have a couple of providers, or you might not have a provider at all. So just now we're seeing the government talk about coming back in and then becoming a provider of last resort.
So the government's got out, created the market of the NDIS, and now the government's coming back in
potentially
to fix up the holes in the NDIS.
Yes. Great. Which also removes that full idea of everyone has choice and control. You have different amounts of choice and control depending on where you live, depending on other factors like, you know, how good you are advocating within a system, but probably also depending on what kind of disability you have as well. If you have something rare, with very particular needs and you live somewhere that's not a capital city, your choice and control will look very different from choice and control of somebody else.
And speaking of different kinds of disability, what about people with mental health problems? What about people who have brain injuries or severe psychosis or depression? Does the NDIS cover people with mental illness?
So if it's something like an acquired brain injury, that's clearer. Because what the NDIS does well is accommodate people who meet that lifelong and severe disability eligibility criteria. So
lifelong and severe disability.
So if you have an acquired brain injury and not a lot is going to change about that, you fit within the kind of terms of the scheme. If you have the more classic mental health scenario where you have something that's episodic that comes and goes, then you will probably struggle. And we see this happening with things like MS, where people tend to have episodes and then they're okay and then they have another episode. So it's not constant, it changes all the time. That's where you can run into trouble. Mental health was a late addition to the NDIS. It wasn't there in the initial kind of campaign for it or when it was first legislated. It was sort of came a few years later. And then there's the review process is what makes it tricky. So at the moment, reviews by the planner that we talked about are usually done on a 12-monthly basis. But you may have a mental health issue that is so episodic that, you know, you have a good month, you have a bad month, you have 2 good months, you have a bad month. And
you mean some people's mental health disabilities don't fit the bureaucratic timetable?
Yes, that's the one.
What are they thinking? Eleanor, how is this working on the ground? Is provision of services to mental health people placing other pressures on this system?
It puts a lot of pressure on the service provider. So some of our work is actually talking to service providers about how they're going with the transition to the NDIS. And through that data...
And who's the service provider? What kind of organisations?
It's a sort of organisation that somebody with a mental health issue could go to if they're in a time of crisis, or they could be taken there. They might be taken there by a family member or a friend or someone on the street or also the police. And so the NDIS switch has put a lot of pressure on people who provide service to episodic mental health, because it means that they might not be paid through the NDIS to give service to that particular person, but that particular person might end up on their doorstep needing help. And these service providers are often very compassionate people who have
been...
We're dealing with NGOs and faith-based organisations who have been working with people with mental health for decades, and they are equipped to help and they want to help. And so they've been saying to us, we end up doing it out of goodwill, and that puts a lot of pressure on that organisation. And like Gemma has said before, we have seen organisations actually deregister from the NDIS for this issue and then a number of other issues around administering the NDIS.
All right, so to wrap up, we created the National Disability Insurance Scheme to provide a broad range of support to people with a broad range of disabilities, and we've now wound up with a system that works well for some people with some disabilities. And when it comes to mental health, we're relying on goodwill and charity to fix problems that the market was going to fix for us.
Yep, that sounds about right. It's particularly problematic where the NDIS touches up against existing systems. So if we take the example of mental health, there can be a lot of buck passing between the healthcare system and the NDIS. So the NDIS might say, it's not our responsibility, it's healthcare responsibility, health system, but the health system might say, but you're funding disability, mental health is part of disability, no, it's your problem. And so you can fall through the gaps, basically.
Wow. So some people might not feel terribly empowered by that bureaucratic buck passing, is what you're saying. Gemma Carey and Eleanor Malbon, thank you very much for coming in to talk to The Lucky Country.
Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.
That was Dr. Gemma Carey and Eleanor Malbon from UNSW Canberra's Public Sector Research Service talking about the NDIS. Last week I asked people to send in any questions they had, and we've been overwhelmed with a wide range of great questions. I won't be able to answer them all, but please keep sending them through and I'll answer as many as I can. Here's a really good one. In response to the conversation we had about population last week, someone wrote in to say, I've heard arguments that letting refugees into Australia will actually help our economy, as more people would mean there's more people to spend money and consume, therefore boosting the economy. Do you think this is true? It's a really important question. There's no doubt that having more people move into a country will lead to GDP growth, gross domestic product growth, which is a bit of a conobabble for the total amount of stuff that's bought and sold and produced in a country. So whether we have big immigration in terms of skilled migration, big immigration in terms of family reunion, or big immigration in terms of refugees, if there's more people in a country making stuff, selling stuff, buying stuff, then the amount of stuff that's made and bought and sold will obviously be bigger. So to be clear, there's absolutely no doubt that rapid population growth, whether it's in the form of skilled migration or refugees, will lead to an increase in the total amount of stuff bought and sold. But is that good for the economy? We usually talk about the size of the economy, GDP, when what really matters, if GDP matters at all, is GDP per person, GDP per capita. So think of it this way. China's got a much bigger economy than Australia, much bigger GDP, but when you divide it by 1.3 billion people, GDP per person is much smaller than it is in Australia. And then you've got small countries like Monaco, which have got a much smaller economy than Australia, much smaller GDP, but a very small and very wealthy population. So when you divide their total GDP by their population, their GDP per person is a lot higher than Australia's. So you wouldn't usually think that people in China on average are wealthier than people in Monaco, because it's actually GDP per person, GDP per capita, that matters to our day-to-day material standard of living. So the economics tells us that when more people come to a country, GDP will grow. That's great for the shops that sell us our groceries. That's great for the banks that give us our credit cards. That's great for the people that that want us to go to the movies, more customers. But in terms of our quality of life, GDP per person, the economic evidence suggests that population growth doesn't really have much impact on GDP per capita at all. Indeed, there's some evidence that suggests that rapid population growth is possibly even bad for average standard of living, GDP per person. Economists can't agree on that, but what we can agree on is just because the population's growing fast and just because GDP is growing fast, that doesn't mean that our material standard of living is getting better. So thanks for your question. I hope that helps. Did that make sense? And that brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production, brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. You can email us on theluckycountry@schwartzmedia.com.au. The show is produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with another edition of The Lucky Country next week. Thanks for listening.